The House redistricting plan continues in Florida despite criticism from Congresswoman Corrine Brown. A lawsuit this week from the St. Jones Riverkeeper, and taxpayers foot the bill under protest for a big settlement involving Governor Scott. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9 on the radio, and now subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday Roundtable. Then later, weird Florida news, plus the music of Jacksonville's own Canary in the Coal Mine. Don't miss their special in-studio performance. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and that means it's time for our weekly roundtable. We're excited to welcome back today Mark Woods of the Florida Times Union. Hey, Mark.
Good morning.
Fred Matthews, who blogs at The Examiner, here today.
Good morning, Melissa.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal, with us.
Good to be here.
And new to the panel, we're excited to welcome Claire Goforth, who writes for Folio Weekly.
Good morning. Thank
hey,
you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Plenty of news from the week for this group to go over, from the Riverkeepers lawsuit to weird Florida news from around the state, and much more. But first this morning, despite sharp criticism from Congresswoman Corrine Brown that it would disenfranchise black voters, the Florida House is moving ahead with a big overhaul of the state's 27 congressional districts. Now, a House panel split along party lines Thursday, and they approved a proposed map that would substantially alter Florida's political landscape, and it could lead to the defeat of several incumbents now in office, including Corrine Brown. We begin the hour with a closer look at this. Let's go to the phones in a moment at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet us. Mark Woods, let's begin with you. You had an interesting column about this the other day, drawing an interesting corollary between Corrine Brown and none other than Donald Trump. Can you explain that?
Well, I kind of argue that for a couple decades now, the congresswoman has been kind of a win-win for the Republican Party because they carved out her district and then created many Republican, heavily GOP districts around it. And then also, I think she leads Republicans to vote Republican, has kept North Florida staunchly red. And so what I said, what Donald Trump is doing for the Democrats right now, Corrine Brown has done for Republicans for a couple decades.
Fred Matthews, as Corrine Brown has argued, and as she stood on the steps of the federal courthouse the other day arguing, she said this is nothing more than another attempt to throw an African-American out of office. She referenced back to an 1800s lawmaker, Josiah Wales, and pointed out that every time he got elected, there were protests, and at one point, white folks burned the courthouse down rather than allow the man to serve in office, drawing historical parallels between the disenfranchisement of black voters in Florida and around the nation to what's happening today. There's disagreement as to whether this redistricting plan is intended to do that, but what are your thoughts about the latest moves on this?
Well, Corrine certainly has always been known to mount spirited arguments. That's how she stayed in office so long, and that's why she's done so well in Congress. But the simple fact of the matter is that you have the League of the Women Voters standing on the side over there. You have the NAACP watching this. They're all in favor of this redistricting and getting these compact districts together instead of what we've had. And that's the problem she has. And now the legislature has done all they can do, not necessarily on Congresswoman Brown's behalf, but they've done all they can do on their own behalf to keep things as they were. But now they're at the point where if they don't do it, at least looking right this time, the judge is going to do it. The court is going to do it. And then you're going to be stuck with something that could be far worse than what you have right now. We could be stuck with what we had in terms of the school busing situation we had some 40 years ago when we sat back and let the court do it.
Right, it's way better to be at that table than to have the judges do it without
without input. And we'll go to your calls on the top stories of the week in just a moment at 549-2937. Claire Goforth, in addition to the controversy over Corrine Brown's district, if it's changed, it will, instead of going down to Orlando, it'll go east-west from Jacksonville to Tallahassee. At the same time, constituents in St. Johns County are protesting, saying that if this plan is approved, their county won't have one congressman. It will have more than one. The county will be split.
That's a fair argument, but I would say that, that's the political process. The voters in Florida were very clear in 2010 that we no longer want these districts that are drawn for political purposes, and that we really want to have them contiguous and, cohesive. It's unfortunate that St. John's County will have to be split into a few congressional districts, but that's just the way that this map is going to have to come out.
And there are also one, possibly two challengers to Corrine Brown, including former state senator Al Lawson, saying he's looking at challenging her under this redrawn map. Tim Gibbons.
That's going to be the interesting bit for not just Corrine, but many incumbents who have this. They were in safe seats, and now they won't be. And that just makes a really fascinating sort of political play where you end up, are people actually trying to defend it because they have a philosophical reason or because they like being incumbents and it's much easier to run when you already have the job?
It's a fact of life in modern day America, Mark Woods, that once you get elected to Congress, you pretty much stay there due to a number of factors, chief among them the way your district lines are drawn. This will change that dynamic.
It could. I mean, if you look at the possible district that would run to Tallahassee, it would still be predominantly Democratic, I think 45% African American. So, her argument that it's going to disenfranchise minorities, I think it could lead to new blood, but likely, some of the rising stars in the African American political community. The mayor of Tallahassee, Andrew Gillum, go to YouTube and watch a couple of his videos and his interviews, and he's pretty powerful.
That's right. Fred Matthews, Andrew Gillum, mayor of Tallahassee, former state senator Al Lawson, both eyeing this seat. How do you see a potential race shaping up in this district?
I mean, I think those are very viable candidates, but even here we have viable candidates that we're going to look up. You have to look at Amia Jones. You have to look at Audrey Gibson. You have to look at Tony Hill, who's still standing out there, who made it all the way to the Senate. They have very strong constituencies, and all of them were simply waiting. After all, Corrine is close to 70 years old, they say, and it could have changed at any point in time. So, yes, this could be quite a contest on the Democratic side. But guess what? If they pile on each other, it could be another opportunity for a good, solid Republican candidate to walk into the seat.
And let's go to your calls on the biggest stories of the week. What are your thoughts about the shakeup of the state's congressional maps? 549-2937. Mark on the west side. Go ahead, Mark. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I just want to point out that I think that this whole conversation is flat ridiculous. If Corrine Brown wants to keep her district, maybe she should get more than 30% of the black people to come out and vote. And the last time I made this point, I got rebuffed by the one black person on your panel saying, oh, well, only 30% of white people come out and vote. But guess what? They don't have a problem getting their people elected.
Mark, thanks for the call. Let's talk about what he had to say.
I'm not sure what that last comment meant, but there is a...
To be fair, it's easier for white people to get elected because there are more white people in this state than... I mean, they are, as of right now anyway, still the majority, although demographics in America are rapidly changing. Tim?
Well, the entire idea of minority access districts is a somewhat fraught one where you're trying to accomplish something that, depending on what light you put it in, is either a helpful thing or not. And I think there's kind of a knife's edge that the entire system is balanced on, that minority representation is a desired goal, but putting all the minorities in one district and having it be an oddly shaped district at that just isn't good for the political process overall.
Fred.
Well, I think that that's where we are now. I think that yes, at the time that this was done, it was very clear. I mean, we hadn't had an African American elected to Congress in 100 years at this point. We hadn't had one elected to the state Senate just 5 or 6 years before that in 100 years. So there was a lot of history that was riding on this issue in 1992, but it's changed now. The voting populace has changed. The ideas behind who's been elected to office has changed. When you look at the districts here in Jacksonville, there's nothing that has changed crime-wise in districts 7, 8, 9, and 10, and they've always been represented by African Americans. So I think a lot of them are looking at that demographic and saying, what difference has it made? Let's look at who's going to be able to represent us in office now, and less about the personality. I think you'll find that rolling through the African American community.
Claire Goforth.
You know, one thing that Corrine keeps saying is one of her talking points is talking about how when you saw the issues in Baltimore and in Ferguson and that in Sanford, that did not happen because they had leadership at the table. But I would make the argument that Congressman Cummings from Baltimore and the Baltimore mayor and the police chief would disagree with that statement. And also would make the point that in those situations, you were looking on police on African-American violence. In the situation in Sanford, no matter what George Zimmerman may have thought of himself, he was not actually a member of the police force.
549-2937 to join the show. Tom, also on the West Side this morning. Hi, Tom. Good morning. Go ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Good morning to you, too. What I was going to say is, with Corrine having the lock on office, I feel like I've been effectively disenfranchised because she represents basically the opposite of what I want when she says that she's in favor of pork, and I'm in favor of fiscal responsibility for our country. It just goes against my wishes, which he does in Washington, and yet there's no way my vote counts because she's got a lock on the district.
Tom, when you say pork, what do you mean by that?
Well, that's what she said earlier in her career, just, you know, pork barrel projects, you know, bringing money into the district regardless of whether or not it was needed.
All right, that's Tom on the West Side. Congress representatives are always accused of pork barrel projects. They do it, though, for a reason.
It can't because be pork barrel if she's bringing it here. I mean, pork is when it's in other people's district.
You know, I mean, there's a reason. The reason representatives do that is because they feel that that's what constituents want. They want projects brought home to their district. Mark Woods.
Sure. And yeah, her slogan has always been Corrine delivers. And that's what she's tried to argue that she can do this. And I think if you're trying to make a case for her, the folks, even, you know, some Republican leaders in town will say, well, when we need something done, we go to her. But I do, you know, back to the caller's point, I think we have all these representatives who have so little challenge to their position. I think on both sides, I want people challenging them.
For example, Fred, Andrew Crenshaw has held his seat for a long time under this redistricting proposal. He still has a very safe seat. He does not look to be facing a real challenge under this proposal.
I mean, that's the funny thing about this discussion is that we have quiet Andrew Crenshaw sitting over there and no discussion about his and the problems that he's having and what he's brought to the table. But Corrine continues to be the whipping boy
for this
whole thing.
Let's talk about Andrew Crenshaw.
Yeah, well, even if we talked about Andrew Crenshaw, it's not a personal thing. It's about the district and its compact size. The issue also has to be, what if you're going to deal with it on a personal level, what has that person brought to office? And I hasten to remind folks that for at least 30 years or more, Jacksonville was represented by only one congressperson. We have a statue of him downtown that any of us, we never knew anybody else to represent Jacksonville for all of those 30 or something years, and nobody really ever knew what he did in Washington. Nobody ever really knew what he did, but you could go to him and ask for little favors, but nobody really knew what he did. And I think we just have to separate the personality from the reality that we have to deal with here. Is the district compact, does it meet what Florida voters voted for? If it doesn't, then we have to fix that. If it does, then leave it alone.
He has a good point there, and it's interesting when we talk about this, the point of this is to give the voters what they want, not to get Corrine out of office. But the last caller basically was saying, yeah, change the district so that I can vote Corrine out of office. Where there's a little bit of animosity toward the congresswoman that I think does get played out as we talk about this. Yes, a horribly gerrymandered district, but it's hard to separate out the fixing that away from the animosity toward the congresswoman.
Can we decide what it's shaped like? I've seen, let's see, snake-like, salamander.
Rorschach blot.
That's the problem. Yeah. If we don't have gerrymandered districts, I don't know how school kids are going to learn those complex shapes. Yeah. I mean, it's a geometry thing.
And again, remember, this district is going to run from Jackson, what they're talking about. Now, if it goes through, I'm running from Jacksonville to Tallahassee. That seems to me not to be necessarily compact. But guess what? The reason why they have to do it is because they have to get at least, I think, about 500,000 people in a congressional district. And they're trying to, and to do that, in North Florida, we only have a few ways to go. Either you go from Jacksonville to Orlando to pick up people, or you go from Jacksonville to Tallahassee and a little beyond to pick up that group. Because between Jacksonville and Tallahassee, there's nothing. There's not not enough people.
All right, let's go to William in Murray Hill now. Hi, William. Go ahead. Good morning, William.
Good morning. How you guys doing?
Doing great.
Okay, listen. My take on this thing is me being a person of color. I'm like one of the gentlemen said, I haven't seen any change at all, whether it's Corrine Brown, Fred, Matthew, Al Lawson. It doesn't matter because, to be honestly, there is so much confusion and frustration, especially economically, and apathy in the black community. Yeah, it doesn't really matter who's in there right now for black folks. Have a good day.
William, I'm sorry you feel that way, although I'm gratified to see your putting Fred Matthews' name out there as a potential representative.
I think
Fred would be great.
If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve.
But what about what he's saying, Claire? That he doesn't think he's so discouraged, he doesn't think it matters who represents him.
I mean, I think that's definitely a shame to hear. And in Florida, we have 400,000 more Democrats than Republicans. And in spite of that fact, we have 10 Democratic representatives in Congress and Senate and 17 Republicans. So I guess that over the past, 25 years that the Republican Party has really held the power in Florida, that people have become disillusioned with not feeling as though they had a voice and feeling as though it's just the status quo business as usual year after year in Congress.
And this Fair District Amendment was intended to level the playing field
precisely
between the parties. Let's take one more call on this. Dan in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for this conversation. I think it's very important. I wanted to respond to a caller who made a comment a few calls ago who talked about representing our people and their people. And I think this entire debate really is it's a shame that we're not talking about our representatives representing everyone and all electorates, regardless of color. I don't think that we should still be framing debates in terms of our and their. And I'd like to hear the panelists discuss that, please.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Mark.
Well, I mean, exact. I mean, obviously, that's what you hope for. I think, you look at Alvin Brown's election proved that this county, that an African-American can win, a countywide election. So I look at that as somewhat of a turning point, that the way Barack Obama's the voting went in the county illustrates, to Fred's point earlier, that, in 1992, I think you did need to create, this very gerrymandered district. But I think things clearly have evolved politically in the last 25 years.
And that's what we're going to have to decide. If you want a nice compact district, then Jacksonville will have one congressperson and the surrounding counties will have the next one. That's what should be done if you want it to be as they prescribe it to be. But guess what? It's not going to happen because nobody's going to put Andrew Crenshaw out of his district. They aren't going to do it. They aren't going to do it in Tallahassee. Corrine is an easy target. You can move that. That's just the political landscape that we're in. Now, if somebody sees something different than this coming out of Tallahassee, tell me. But Jacksonville would only get one congressperson. It'd be one congressperson represented because we have enough here to get a congressperson elected, whatever the color, and Andrew would have to find him an outside county to get elected from. That's a compactness of districts, but that political reality is not going to happen.
And it's a great discussion, but we do need to move on and talk about a few other headlines from the week. One involving the St. John's Riverkeeper on Tuesday. The Riverkeeper filed a notice of intent to sue the Army Corps of Engineers over the proposed St. John's River Harbor Deepening Project. The Riverkeeper says there's a failure to provide mitigation for environmental damage that would result from dredging the river. They want to dredge it down to a depth of 47 feet to accommodate what are known as Panamax-ready cargo ships expected from the widening of the Panama Canal. Tim Gibbons, the business community Foursquare behind this deepening project, saying it will bring jobs and more economic development to our area. What are your thoughts about the lawsuit?
There's a weird inertia to this entire thing where we've been talking and writing about the deepening of the shipping channel for years and years and years. Obviously, we're closer now in that we have permission to do the work. We still don't have the money. And the Riverkeeper has been kind of more or less opposed to this for at least 4 or 5 years. Again, that conversation just keeps on going around. Lawsuit had to be filed basically because there was a statutory deadline that it had to be filed within. Lisa Reinemann has said that if the Rodman Dam project, basically removing that dam, is done, that they would withdraw from the lawsuit. So,
right. Claire Goforth.
This is a very big issue, and I've written about it personally. One of the things that we keep looking at is the economic benefit to the city. Honestly, given the fact that there are plans for 10 deep water ports on the eastern seaboard alone, it doesn't seem as though Jacksonville is going to garner enough of an economic benefit or increased cargo. There's a finite amount of cargo. Savannah is miles ahead of us. They're starting their project in just a month. We don't have the money. The environmental impact is questionable. And $3 million for mitigation is really a drop in the bucket, mm-hmm. even with a lot of unknowns out there. If you look at the blue crab industry and the shrimp industry, those could both be negatively affected by this project. And we haven't even considered that really as a city.
Mark Woods, the Army Corps says it's vetted this project, looked at impact. All along, there's been this push and pull between the projected number of jobs and the projected costs versus what realistic projections are. And how this community will foot the bill for this project, that's still up in the air, actually.
Oh, right. There's still tons of questions. The federal money, the state money, the local money. Other than that, it's all resolved. But the mitigation, I think, is a big piece of this lawsuit, that, less than $3 million for that. And the Riverkeeper points out that, lawsuits in Savannah and Miami led to more mitigation that they would not have had. And even so, in Miami, even with that, they had all kinds of issues and they had to sue again. So I think without someone like the Riverkeeper fighting for this, we were setting ourselves up for potential, lots of environmental damage.
And Fred, what about Claire's point that ports all up and down the eastern seaboard are ahead of Jacksonville when it comes to preparing for these bigger ships, that there's no guarantee we'll attract the cargo? What do you think about that argument?
Well, I mean, clearly our city leadership is bought into that. I mean, we got to do what everybody else is doing. We got to get what everybody else is getting, regardless of the costs, and I think we've had this discussion before here, and that our city leaders are going to pursue it because they want to catch up, they want to get all this business done, but it's ironic that I guess it's just timing that this lawsuit now pops up right after the mayor decides to dissolve the committee that was having this discussion, put it all back into the hands of the Port Authority, which won't have any discussion, doesn't have any environmentalists on the committee. Yes, Reinemann says it was going to happen anyway, but I guess the mayor had to look at this too and says, well, if we're going to get sued about it, we're not going to have any discussions. Let's move full steam ahead.
But we've talked about the Ports Task Force before. I mean, calling it window dressing might be, an insult to curtains. It was a group of people who very much had looked at this issue and thought about it and talked about it and studied it, and all had come to the conclusion that the dredging should be done. So,
except the Riverkeeper.
But one,
and Professor White from
and right, Quint White, the right, one environmentalist.
The one person whose voice was as loud as he could make it, but isn't one person on the committee. So the idea that somehow the committee was having this discussion, it wasn't really what it was anyhow, at which point you say, well, why bother having it? The only point that the committee had at all was coming up with a recommendation for how to pay for it. So that was like the one thing that maybe they could add to, but they got disbanded before.
And they were pushing for more mitigation. They agreed that even the business folks, I think all over town, people realize the river is a very valuable asset.
So Tim, you cover the business community. There is near unanimity among the business community that we need this project. What about the business case?
The idea is that even if it does not have the huge growth sort of benefits, if the channel is not deep and Jacksonville basically ceases to be a port city, then we end up with, there's a finite amount of cargo and all of these other ports, just it all goes to them. The particularly the Asian trade that the city fought so hard to get would just vanish. So it's basically a decision of, do we want to be a logistics hub or not? If not, okay, go down that path.
So who's going to give us the money? If we had the money today, they'd do it today. So who's going to give us the money to do it?
That's right. And no one has an answer to that question. Claire.
I mean, how are we going to come up with $400 million, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are other things that we could do. We could try to specialize in ships that come out of the Caribbean that don't need this deep draft. We could try to improve our infrastructure. We have issues with our transportation infrastructure already. I mean, and that's one of the costs that really isn't considered when we talk about the dredging. We talk about how much the dredging costs, but in the reality, we would also have to improve the highway system and the rail system. And that number, I mean, who knows how much that could cost?
Right. Well, if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we discuss the top stories of the week with Tim Gibbons, Claire Goforth, Fred Matthews, and Mark Woods, 549-2937 to join the show. Another news item, a bit of outrage this week at the news that Florida's legal bill to defend Governor Rick Scott grew substantially. The governor's office released documents showing he has agreed to pay his lawyers $300,000 additionally for defending him in two open government cases that got settled. The legal fees on top of the nearly $1 million taxpayers have already spent to defend the governor and cabinet in these cases. This was over public records. Mark Woods, your thoughts?
Well, I would never beat up on the governor.
Never, never.
Well, the Orlando Sentinel.
Why do you think I asked you?
Had an interesting editorial basically saying, you know, why should the taxpayers be paying this? You know, this is the governor reaching into his own pocket if he's going to, you know, break public records laws and that he should foot this bill, which I might echo.
Fred.
Well, I mean, you know, the governor has paid for enough. He paid for his campaign. He's paying for his own jet. At least he did the first term. I mean, he's paid for a great deal of things. And I think that, you know, now the taxpayers can defend our governor at least one time out of the, you know, 20 or 30 times that this stuff is going on.
Well, and if he has to pay for it himself, he might end up like, I don't know, releasing the public records and stuff. You know, he couldn't do it if he had to pay himself.
Exactly. This had to do with an allegation that Scott and the cabinet violated state open meeting laws when they ousted former Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Gerald Bailey with no public vetting process. Claire.
Previous one, and this
recent
one. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would actually agree with Fred that there is a dangerous precedent to be set in requiring the governor to, or any public official, to pay for the lawsuit, you know, in reference to their official actions. In this case, there definitely is some willful misconduct on the governor's part, in my opinion. So I think that this may be a rare exception to sovereign immunity, but at the same time, I would hesitate to just have him stroke a check.
All right. Eric in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Eric. Thanks for calling. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Regarding the defending of the port, one of your panelists mentioned that there are 10 deep water ports, all of whom supersede us. Well, that is actually not correct. We are part of a system of distribution of cargo on the East Coast where these ships come in and distribute ports to the various ports. And part of the benefit of that and the benefit of having Jacksonville and other ports like Jacksonville maintain their position within this rotation is that that cargo is less likely to end up on the roads, in traffic, on trucks. It is distributed more efficiently that way. It's important that we, in the Port of Jacksonville, maintain our position within the rotation on the East Coast. Also, on the environmental side, much has been made about the increase of salinity in the St. John's River as a result of dredging over the last 20 years. The salinity has increased, that is true, and it's primarily as a result of sea level rise. I think if they looked at other estuaries in Florida and looked at the difference in salinity now versus 20 years ago, they would see a similar rise. I don't think that they possess the calculus to say that it is due to dredging.
All right. Thanks, Eric, for that. Lots of very informed callers this morning. We want to make a quick note that this weekend marks the first Jaguars preseason game, and as fans hope the team has a decent season this year, the city's business and political class continue to forge a complicated relationship with Jaguars owner Shad Khan, whether it comes to his planned shipyards development, the scuffle over the Edgewood Bakery that resulted in some negative press, or the Kin Incubator. Claire Goforth.
When Shad Khan first came on the scene, the city essentially rolled out the red carpet for him. We were very excited. We have this billionaire who's going to take an active interest in city politics and business. In the years since that, it does feel as though he his welcome, has he worn out his welcome by with missteps such as with the Edgewood Bakery or pulling the funding from Kin, or has city leadership decided that they really don't want this outsider to have such a large voice in city politics?
You think that's being discussed?
I think that that's definitely part of the pushback against him.
Tim Gibbons.
I can see that more in the shipyards. I think the Kin, probably should stick the Barnett Bank building in there, the other lawsuit that Khan's Stash Investment is involved in. There's this weird thing of when he came in, the red carpet was rolled out, and I think people almost thought it was like Santa Claus showed up. You know, instead of the big white beard, he had a mustache. But but the idea that he came in, he's making investments, and he wants to return on those investments.
Yeah.
And there was some sort of attitude of almost, you know, wait, you actually want to make money on this? I thought you were just, you know, kind of buying goodwill.
Well, look, I mean, Shad Khan is a businessman first and last, and he's brought a different style to these deals than maybe some in the Jacksonville community have been used to, Mark and Fred.
I think he still has a lot of, I mean, pretty beloved here. You know, talk about when he started here. So, in some ways, the red carpet was rolled out, but in other ways, folks were very skeptical.
Uh-huh.
Who's this outsider? He
right.
seems kind of foreign. You know, there was and then when I was amused when he bought Fulham, the English soccer team, the tabloids all over there were saying this American has bought it. You know? But now I think he's been embraced as one of Jacksonville's own. Now, if the Jaguars continue to play like they have played, that I think a lot of this, you see it play out with sports, is do you win?
Yeah, sure.
And if he wins, I think it helps him get the shipyards done, gets city
that
leaders.
That would be a business win.
Yes, and if they don't,
Fred.
Then...
Fred.
Well, I mean, Mr. Khan held a Shark Tank-like event this past week. I think it was yesterday that may get picked up by one of the network where we're all sitting around and doing the same thing. He came in and made your pitch to the billionaires and see who would pick it up. Looks like a couple of them might go with. That's been his theme. It's been business, business, business. If it's a good business deal, I'll do it. If it's not, well, you need to think about it. What is also missing here is what Jacksonville likes and what the South likes is that it's like to see the whole person. We still don't know who Shad Khan is, except for what we read in Forbes and Time about his big apartment in Chicago and all the gold and glitter and all that stuff. We still don't know who he is. And that's a part of this picture that's missing. And I can tell you that for many in the business, local business community, we know them. We know Peyton. We know we got to know the Weavers. We got to know all of these people who have been business people first. And that's the part of the picture with Shad Khan that's missing.
That is an excellent point and a great discussion. But we do want to close with a look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week around the state. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida. Now, only in Florida does the sight of a cute animal cause a major traffic accident involving lots of beer, although it was Bud Light, so some may question whether it actually was beer.
Watch it.
Police in Brooksville say a truck driver hauling a big load of Bud Light flipped over the big rig and spilled hundreds of cans all over I-75. This guy, 23-year-old Malcolm Wilcox of Fernandina Beach, says he drifted off the shoulder of the road because he was distracted by his adorable puppy riding in the cab with him. The cute dog in question was later photographed with Wilcox assessing the havoc he wrought.
My.
No comment from Tim Gibbons.
I don't.
Only in Florida do people go to the police station to complain their drugs have been stolen. 47-year-old Boyd Gene Wiley came into the Putnam County Sheriff's Office Monday and complained detectives had stolen his patch of marijuana plants. He said they'd removed the marijuana without his permission and that it was medical marijuana. But growing medical marijuana is still illegal in Florida. Wiley is under arrest.
Best line in that story was, you know, they were trying to find out who owned it.
And finally, only in Florida do news anchors rise up in protest against the Kardashians. Yes, anchor John Brown, who co-hosts Good Day Orlando at WOFL-TV in Orlando, lost his cool and walked off the set Friday during a live show. The reason? The Kardashian clan. The glorious moment came during a segment about Kylie Jenner's newest pet rabbit, who she has named Bruce. Brown couldn't take it anymore. Take a listen to his epic rant.
Okay, I'm having a good Friday, so I refuse to talk about the Kardashians today. You are on your own, Amy. I can't do it. I've had enough Kardashians. I can't take any more Kardashian stories on this show. I don't care. This family. I'm sick of this family.
But do you see
how I can't take it anymore.
Is there something psychological behind this?
It's a non-story. It's a non-story. We're talking about this family every freaking day on this show. Nobody cares about this family anymore.
That's anchor John Brown of Good Day Orlando.
That's my hero. Right there.
the new hero of our media roundtable. And you guys are my heroes because you make this show great every Friday. Fred Matthews, Mark Woods, Tim Gibbons, and Claire Goforth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Melissa.
And we're back in a moment.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
Hi, I'm Evan Willman. I typically listen to the station when I'm in my my home office. I work out of my house a lot. I have my HD radio in there. So this is really the best of all worlds. It gives me my news. It gives me music that constantly delights and surprises me.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to announce that Mary Enworth will be this year's morning keynote speaker at Teach. Mary is co-author of Pathways to the Common Core. She is deputy director of middle schools at the Teachers Reading and Writing Project, Columbia University. Mary is just one of the many great speakers you will hear throughout the day. For more information or to purchase tickets, go to WJCT/teach.
Push things past the breaking point. Put everything on the line. Then you're supposed to get what's coming. Maybe. Maybe not. On the next Snap Judgment, crash and burn. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, this Saturday, don't miss WJCT and Baptist Health's Girls Day Out event, a day filled with everything that's good for you. And one keynote speaker will share concepts behind a great initiative. It's called Life Reimagined. I spoke about it with Leslie Spencer, Associate State Director for Advocacy for AARP. Leslie Spencer, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let me ask you by starting out, what is Life Reimagined?
Great question. Life Reimagined is really a new way of thinking about dreaming, exploring, and deciding what's next in your life. It really introduces a powerful step-by-step approach that helps people discover their possibilities, prepare for change, and make their ideas real. And we've heard from folks that the key areas that they're interested in are work, health, and relationships. So Life Reimagined is there to help with guidance, inspiration, and motivation, and really to make those personal connections for folks.
Sure. And so many will benefit from hearing this information. This is of interest to so many people. How did AARP develop this program and decide to offer this?
We were really hearing from people that they were looking for reputable, practical guidance to help them through life transitions and everything that's associated with a new life phase. So Life Reimagined was developed by AARP in partnership with some of the world's leading experts and researchers, life coaches, entrepreneurs, to help with that personal development and create the Life Reimagined methodology.
There's also a Life Reimagined checkup. What is that?
Yes, I know. It sounds interesting, doesn't it? We call it a checkup specifically because we all get a health checkup. We go for our annual physical. We do a checkup on our finances. We get our cars checked up, but rarely do we take time to do a checkup on our life. So a checkup is an in-person local experience that helps people understand where they are, allows time for reflection, and then think about what their next move might be. Attendees will use a Life Reimagined journal as part of that process in reflecting, which is really a key component of this, and then looking forward to see what the possibilities are and really think about their gifts, passions, values, and goals for the future. And the great thing is they can connect with others in the room who may be going through some of the same transitions. So it's a personalized system based on the individual, but it also allows you to make community connections as well.
And people face these transition points throughout their lives, but in particular, as people get closer to retirement age, these issues really become critical for so many, don't they?
They do. They do. And Life Reimagined is certainly a part of that, because as we go through life, it's not a straight line. There are twists and turns, and these transitions are triggers which can have you go one way or the other. And certainly for many, that looming idea of retirement is, okay, now what am I going to do? And for some folks, they know exactly what they want, and it's just assistance in finding those resources. But for others, it's really this open field of opportunity, and Life Reimagined really helps them explore what's out there for them. And for some folks, it may be, you know what, I want to open my own business. So retirement is not the traditional view that we've had in the past. It's not at 65, you get a gold watch and you sit on the front porch. For many people, it opens up a realm of possibilities. And that is what's so fun and exciting about Life Reimagined.
Well, it's going to be a highlight of our Girls Day Out event at the Hyatt this weekend, and we're so pleased to have you join us this morning. Leslie Spencer, Associate State Director for Advocacy with AARP. Leslie, thanks so much, and enjoy your time with us this weekend.
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to it.
And there's still time to buy tickets for WJCT's Girls Day Out. Good for you. It's all day tomorrow at the Downtown Hyatt. Health screenings, fun, giveaways, great speeches, breakout sessions, and more. Visit wjct.org/goodforyou. And back in a moment, as Jacksonville's own Canary in the Coal Mine performs right here in studio. That's next.
So I go home and I tell my mother, and I say, Ma, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to work to clean up hazardous waste. I'm going to be an engineer. My grandmother said, baby, why do you want to work on a train?
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT. WJCT is proud to be your number one preset for your evening commute. But if you only turn on 89.9 when you're driving, here's what you're missing.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for
listening. This is The World.
Spend your afternoons with WJCT for unique conversations about the topics of the day. Join us weekdays from 2 to 6 for The Takeaway, The World, and All Things Considered. It's the smart way to spend your afternoon.
Welcome back. Well, Jacksonville's own Canary in the Coal Mine will be opening tonight for the Grammy Award-winning Jim Lauderdale at a special concert at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. They released their first full-length album, Who Fears the Devil, earlier this year. We're pleased to welcome in studio right now Jessica Pounds, Arvid Smith, Peter Mosley, and Philip Pan of Canary in the Coal Mine. Guys, good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Exciting. You'll be opening up for the Grammy Award-winning Jim Lauderdale concert tonight. And Brett Bass from Grandpa's Cough Medicine will also be sitting in. Lots of local talent on display.
Yes, we're very excited about this show and the opportunity to open up for Jim. We've had the opportunity to play with him at Spring Fest and Magnolia Fest the past several years, so this is a good pairing that we're really proud to be a part of.
So tell us about the new album, Who Fears the Devil?
Well, the album, we spent a long time working on it. It was produced by Matt Grandin with Parlor Studios in New Orleans, and we released it this past March. It is a collection of 10 songs, which we're going to be playing a good amount of that at the Jim Lauderdale show. We also have some new tunes that we've worked out that we're looking forward to having the audience hear as well.
And you've developed a specific sound. If North Florida, the North Florida music scene has a genre or a sound or an identity, you're one of the groups that I think defines it. How do you think that sound has developed here in this community and with your band?
Well, I think there's been a little bit of a resurgence of acoustic music that kind of counters a lot of electronic music that has happened. And so we've, you know, kind of, we're part of this Americana folk resurgence, but we've got a little bit of a modern and alternative twist to what we do to, you know, kind of make sure we have our own flavor within the genre.
It'll be an exciting show Friday night, but we have a preview right now as Canary in the Coal Mine performs. What song are you going to be performing for us?
We are going to be playing two songs. They're both new songs. One is called Keep It to Yourself, and the second is called Only Gun.
Here they are now, Canary in the Coal Mine.
This one's called Keep It to Yourself.
You don't have to tell me this isn't love, 'cause believe me, and no. You don't have to tell me this isn't love, 'cause believe me, believe me, I know. I've been fighting with the ghost, run around all the places I used to know. I can't hide it no more. You don't have to tell me this is love, 'cause believe me, and no. You don't have to tell me this isn't love, 'cause believe me, and no.
I taste the whiskey on your breath. I'm just a stranger with you in some other woman's bed. Keep pulling me close and shaking on the only one.
You don't have to tell me this isn't love.
Jacksonville's own Canary in the Coal Mine opening tonight for Jim Lauderdale at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. You can see a video of that performance from our Studio 5 sessions. It's on our WJCT Facebook page.
And that's our program. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Enjoy your weekend, and let's get the weekend started with a little more music from Canary in the Coal Mine.
This song is called Only Gun. Licked her belly, she sank to the ground. The pure holy fire in her, she felt an unseen power. Sweet old music she spent so long tracking down. Long aloud as she felt each show ringing out. Was she pulling her back down the road of the realm? I know you want her to be, but she ain't a baby now. You better watch her,
'cause you ain't the only gun in this town.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.